Okay, so welcome. Now we get to continue exploring this, what is it, transcendental, independent arising, dependent arising? There's different ways we talk about it. It's basically this pathway out of suffering into liberation. We often focus on understanding suffering, understanding the nature of it, like through dependent origination or Four Noble Truths. But this is like another pathway that instead of going from a place of reinforcing our suffering through our ignorance, through our confusion, we actually go into a place of faith, which then grows into more and more confidence in the practice. So at this point in the series, we're starting to explore kind of what we actually see, what we're actually understanding nature to be, understanding the nature of ourselves, the nature of the Dharma, the nature of how we are in the world, how we create suffering, and how we also have that liberation. A capacity for liberation. This is also an interesting point. Like, mindfulness is such a big part of our society these days. You can hear mindfulness, be mindful of this and that. But really, mindfulness is designed to calm our systems, to calm our, kind of balance our energies. That's what a lot of this year has been to this point, develop that steadiness of attention. But in order to see clearly, in order to see through, to understand what is confused, what is deluded, to actually see the nature of things. So in other words, mindfulness itself, a lot of the things we've drawn to is calming our spirit, calming our hearts, being more present. Those are all wonderful things, and they're ultimately a side effect. The real purpose of practice is what we're getting into right now, is really understanding the nature of liberation, the nature of our hearts opening. The release of suffering. And so that's just an important piece to touch upon here. Sometimes you see this phrase in the suttas when they're talking about people having dust over their eyes, dust in their eyes, and how that obscures the way we see, our capacity to fully perceive and understand the nature of things. And practice is about clearing that dust off our eyes. So if you look at the mindfulness technique or instructions from that perspective, in some ways you can see how they're really tailor-made to allow us to see without prejudice, without preconception, and to see with clarity. To see something clearly, we have to get rid of our preconceptions about it. If we're seeing through our preconceptions, we don't see the actual thing. We're seeing our minds kind of reflected back at us. If our minds aren't steady, we can't really land enough to see something in a more full, deep way. This is the power of concentration. So this month, talking about knowledge and vision, I'm going to kind of set aside the vision piece right now, but focus more on the knowledge. I think knowledge is also helpful to unpack that for a moment. Because this day and age, we have access to so much Dharma knowledge, right? We can go online and our search can give us more things we can read in a lifetime, right? We can go to a bookstore and find probably hundreds, if not thousands, of books about the Dharma. So we're really almost flooded with information. Now, there's a difference between intellectual understanding and direct knowing, confirmed knowing, something that you've seen immediately in your own experience, something that you know for yourself to be true. And so this is a point where in our practice in this series is really start to bring our attention to this direct knowing. What have we actually perceived? Because things you know for yourself, that not because you believe in them, not because someone taught you that or told you it's a good thing, but things you've seen directly, immediately, those things you know to be true. You know them in a deep way. You know them in your cells of your body. You know them in your heart. There's a quality of being unshakable. And as we practice, we come to practice with different levels of knowledge. You have knowledge of intellectual knowledge, knowledge of the Buddhist teachings, versus how much practice history we have. My own practice history, my teacher tended to not teach very classically. He didn't teach a lot of the suttas until a little bit later. He was more really focused on building this capacity to see clearly and particularly to understand this nature of self. And then I started to do one of the Spirit Rock trainings, like the dedicated practitioner program. And when I actually started to hear some of the teachings, sometimes for the first time, and it was an interesting experience because I had never heard of them after 10 years of practice, but actually hear them and see how they connected with my experience. It was like I had been exploring this terrain, like out in the woods, and understanding the ravines and the draws, the hills and all those things, really getting connected to them, but never seeing the map that showed the whole terrain and how that area I had been exploring connected to this much bigger piece. So sometimes our practice goes that way, that we practice, we learn how to meditate, we learn how to clear the lens of our perception, to clear the distortion so we can see in a clear, direct, immediate way. And then the teachings kind of inform what we're seeing, help us connect what we're seeing with this bigger roadmap that the Buddha offered. He offered several roadmaps toward liberation, to understanding this human condition. Other times we learn the map first. Maybe we learned it in school, or we're drawn to, you know, listening to talks and doing lots of reading. And there's nothing wrong with that. It gives us this idea of the roadmap and the terrain. But we also have to realize we actually have to walk the terrain. We actually have to get on the ground and see what does that stream look like outside the little blue line on the map. But what does it actually look like to put our feet in it, to actually drink from it? Don't drink from streams without purifying it. Public service message there. But you know what I'm talking about, to really experience it. So in some ways, what I'm talking about in this talk is insight. So one way we describe this practice is insight meditation. It's part of our name, Seattle Insight, right? It's like Seattle Insight or Insight Meditation Society back in Barre, Massachusetts. So this is insight is a way of describing this word Vipassana. You know, some of you have done like the 10-day Goenka retreats with the Vipassana method. But Vipassana is not just a proprietary name for that particular school of meditation, which is very renowned, very well respected. Vipassana literally means to see clearly and to understand what you're seeing. So to clarify, to purify, to see what it is, and also to understand that. Now, insights are something that reorders the very way we perceive ourselves and the world. Right, so it's you know, in some ways we can say it's an aha moment, but it's also an aha moment that suddenly has changed the very assumptions you based your life upon. That's especially at this level we're talking about with transcendental dependent origination. It's this reordering, this recalibration. Because what the Buddha discovered and what we discover today is that we have these patterns of mind, these habits of mind, these assumptions that perpetuate our suffering. And we don't even realize it because we think that's how things are. There's these basic assumptions that keep things going. And we try this and try that, and we have some success, we have some failure, but it seems like there's always this inner lack, this inner turmoil, this inner insufficiency. Dharma practice starts to show us those assumptions and to see through them, to see the release of them. And that's part of what I want to explore tonight. And I think we can all draw upon our own experience with the difference between kind of intellectual knowing and direct knowing. This year, I was able to go snorkeling for the first time. Haven't heard about it for many years and read about it and seen it in movies and to see the magicalness of it. But all that I knew about it was very different than being immersed in the water and being that intimate with the waves and the wildlife, you know, to see a sea turtle going by very close. It's, you know, it's like you're much, in some ways you're more vulnerable because you're not like removed from it. You're like right there and it's the magicalness of it. There's this immersion that happens. And that's what practice does, is we start to hear some of the Dharma concepts, but they're meant not to be concepts, but something that we experience directly for ourselves. You know, another example is a long time ago when I was in my late teens, early 20s, I worked for the Forest Service, and they told us, okay, drive safely on the roads, because if you go too fast on a gravel road, you can start to skid out of control. Being young, arrogant, male, I thought, oh, I know, I can go fast. Then one day I was on this road way in the back in the woods, and I started to skid out of control. And it was a very visceral experience. And luckily, well, there's a ditch on one side and there's a cliff on the other side. Luckily, I went to the ditch side, not so much from what anything I did, but just the luck of it, and then got pulled out by the road crew and all that. But that taught me the difference between the idea of a skid and the actual felt experience of it. Right? So life teaches us those lessons. And the Dharma in some ways lets us learn those lessons more clearly, more subtly, more fully. Another example around this sense of understanding moving into a transformation is like my journey around systemic racism, right? So, growing up, I grew up in New Mexico. And so I thought, I'm not really racist. I don't really feel that edge, right? So there's a sense of kind of denying that, pushing that away. But after, it takes a while to kind of work through that, to see that. When I actually started to see how my perceptions really had a quality of otherness, of creating this sense of separation. And when I started to really own the fact that my vision was distorted, the way I perceived was distorted, then I was able to start to actually really meet it and heal it and learn from it, to not discount that the power of that, the power of the systemic racism. And so Dharma has that quality of, I'm going to just say this, I think it's true, that Dharma has this quality of alleviating suffering, if it's really true Dharma. It has a quality of alleviating suffering in ourselves and in others. Now knowledge, things we see through our direct knowing, our direct experience, there's a couple pieces around that. On one hand, we want to be careful about extrapolating too much of what we see, because we just have a limited experience on something. It's just our meeting this mind in one way. The classic tale from the suttas is an elephant being and a group of people without sight coming by to feel it and trying to describe what they felt, and also being really invested in their limited experience, arguing what an elephant actually was. Someone taking the tusk and saying, oh, it's like this long, smooth spear. Another one is saying, no, it's not like that at all. It's like the hearing, feeling the ear, feeling the thing, the flappiness of it, the trunk and the legs. And so the point of it is when we start to buckle down on our belief, we see something directly, and then we start to go from that direct seeing as an alive awareness and as an alive insight, we start to harden it into an opinion, into a belief, right? You can see in the greater world how many religions have that. This is the belief, you have to believe it, and there's a sense of a lot of violence that comes from that, from that hardness. But we can do that too in the Dharma. We could have an insight and we start to own it, we start to solidify it, instead of allowing it to be an alive process. So when you have an insight, when you see something, allow it to be a process that's arising and evolving. It's not something that you, when you write it down and carve it into stone and put it over your mantle or something, it's getting too strong, right? And really what's happening is we start to form a quality of identification around it. This is my belief. And you're less than because you don't have that belief. On the other hand, it's actually helpful to extrapolate our insights, right? So I'm kind of giving you mixed messages. If we take it into a sense of identification and solidification, that's not so helpful. But for the other hand, we say that this one seeing is actually a glimpse into a hologram, that we see one part of it, we start to see all these other parts. That's why the Dharma is actually very accessible, because all the people, there's 100 or so people here listening in the room, each one of us has a different entry place into the Dharma. Maybe it's through suffering in a particular way, just butting your head against it until it finally gives way, and you see there's another way of practicing. You let give up around your stubbornness. Maybe there's a quality of wanting to be gentle, wanting to be kind, to be connected. Maybe it's the wisdom teachings. I really want to understand impermanence and anatta, non-self. But each of those gateways is something that we walk through. And as we all walk and really understand one part of the Dharma, the rest of it starts to reveal itself. And you can see that if you have a particular Dharma topic or concept that you really transform from intellectual understanding to direct knowing, then you can see how that's mirrored in so many other teachings. It actually you feel the resonance, you feel the connection. Right? And this way, it's a really an alive process. It's a sense of movement. And just to be aware of this very human tendency to kind of consolidate around our understanding, our belief, and say, okay, this is mine now. I can hold on to it. The Dharma is meant to start to thin this sense of self, to start to make this sense of self more quiet, less established. So let's get a little bit more specific to kind of help ground this around different types of knowledge and vision that we can understand, or different types of insight that arises in our practice. A handy list is the three characteristics. These cover a lot of territory. A lot of territory in terms of how we mistakenly see things, and how through our practice it transforms into direct seeing, a direct knowing, a direct understanding. This is moving from the map into the train. It's actually seeing things from the intellectual understanding to the direct knowing. Let's start with impermanence, or Nietzsche. So impermanence is one of those things that we can understand pretty easily intellectually. That, yeah, things change. Okay, what's next, right? But to actually really see it in an immediate way. A very personal way to look at this is look at old photos of yourself. You know, most of us, we don't look the same as we did 10 or 20 or 30 or 40 or 50 years ago. We see this process of aging, this process of change. Sometimes we change in a positive way, sometimes in a way we maybe don't like so much. A lesson I learned from my grandfather when he was dying, he was a Christian person, Christian fellow, Christian believer, whatever the word, practitioner. You don't always say Christian practitioners. He was a Christian. So he was talking to me one day about this phrase that this too shall pass, and how that was often seen as one of the most profound statements. And as he said that, I was thinking, yeah, maybe this is a way of reframing his own passing, his own death, his own mortality, that this too shall pass. And then he wanted to shave. He was always clean shaven, but he had become quite scruffy. And so he was wheelchair bound. We cleared the hallway to get him down to his little bathroom, and he saw his image after maybe not seeing it for a couple of weeks. And he was shocked by what he saw. He said, "Is that me? Is that really me?" And in that moment, I realized, okay, this is a deeper understanding of impermanence. This is not an intellectual understanding. This is that this body too, is going to die. This too, body too, is changing. So this quality of impermanence, it really deserves our attention to really connect with. Now, impermanence, there's the kind of the downer side of it, right, of old age, sickness, and death. But there's also the moment-by-moment impermanence, which is really, in some ways, a lovely teacher. Once we get used to it, once we relax into it, our minds don't like change for the most part. We kind of like things to be static. We like to have things set. That's part of this kind of pitfall with insight, is our mind wants to take something that opens us up and coalesce it back into something we can hold on to. It's actually meant to keep opening us up. So impermanence is something that we can access really through our meditation practice. So how many of us have been taught to meditate with the breath? You know, it's probably almost everyone. You know, that's the common gateway. So, you know, it's a common way of practicing. And it's so easy to kind of overlook the fact that it's constantly changing, that no breath is exactly the same. Each breath is a little bit different. And that's why one of the reasons we teach it is that when you really start to notice that and really, you know, let go of the idea of breath and the kind of the distancing of that idea to the felt sense of it, you start to really live this experience of change. This teaches you how to live with other change. Same thing with sound. I can ring this bell and we hear one sound. Well, if we listen closely, we actually can hear the fluxation, the sine waves are rising and passing, the kind of the beats that go through the air. Many of us really start to understand impermanence through something like physical, mental, or emotional pain. Because often with pain, you know, we don't really like to, it's painful, right? We don't want to be with it. We turn away from it. But if you've ever practiced, as I'm sure many of you have, with actually turning toward it, to actually be with it. Okay, the caveat, you know, you have to have discernment. If it's really a big pain, if it's a pain of deep loss, it's a pain of that's really shakes you and makes you feel less stable, then you want to kind of titrate or go slowly with this. But kind of the pain that you can be present with, that you can still open to and still feel your feet, still feel your breath, still be aware of your surroundings. Turn toward it with a quality of curiosity. Physical pain is a great way to practice it. Because often we feel pain, it's just, okay, it just hurts, it hurts. I don't want to really feel it. But if I actually drop the label of pain and go into the sensations of it, I start to sense that actually it's not one thing. It's actually there's a movement in it. There's a sense of flux with it. There's a sense of pulsing with it. There's a shape that's changing. Same thing with mental pain and emotional pain. Mental and emotional pain are a little, it's actually similar with pain, with physical pain. There's often a belief that's keeping us fixed around it. One friend of mine who had chronic pain said a big piece for him was learning to divorce his fear from his pain, to actually be able to experience the pain without the fear of it, or the fear of the future, the fear of the past becoming the future. Right, so with physical pain, mental pain, emotional pain, there's often some belief, something that we're taking very personally that keeps us from really opening to it. Where we can loosen that sense of self-identification, start to loosen, explore it actually as a felt sense in the body, as a mental state, then we start to see it actually is also changing. And when we do that, we start to learn something really important, that's the way we relate to experience either amplifies our suffering or decreases our suffering. I meet it with a lot of restriction, a lot of resistance. There's more pain that comes from that. Meet with very little resistance, with curiosity. The pain actually is less than our minds tell it is. It's often attributed to Mark Twain, but it may have been someone else, that some of the worst things that ever happened to me never actually did. You know, as we our minds project the worst case scenario. And as we practice in this way, there's this gateway as our minds accommodate to the fact of impermanence that goes beyond kind of the trepidation and fear of it into the wonder on the other side of it, the wonder, the mystery of that. And we notice this, like maybe in nature, or maybe you're with someone that you're falling in love with, or you're seeing something that's just so beautiful, you're somewhat speechless, and you're just living this experience. You're being with it, you're seeing what's arising. You're not needing to control it or orchestrate it or keep it here longer than it is. You celebrate the fact that it's here, and you release it when it releases. Sometimes I like to instruct meditation with the breath. It's like you're receiving it in a full-hearted way and exhaling, releasing it in a full-hearted way. This allows us to be in harmony with the quality of impermanence. Now, dukkha, the next characteristic, the next one I want to talk about, is also a powerful teacher in our lives. And it's a powerful way to learn to move from this sense of idea to the, actually the idea of understanding it, seeing it directly. So I noticed this, as those of you gone through my intro class or have heard my teaching, I often use this example around the second dart. And a big part of it, when my teacher framed it, was around resistance, not resisting experience or allowing experience to be just how it is. So I spent a lot of time trying to allow experience to be how it is, teaching me how not to add that second dart. Second dart, if you're not familiar, you get hit by a dart, everyone feels the pain, whether you're the Buddha or, you know, name your favorite politician. We all feel the same level of pain. But if we have that, if you've been practicing, we just feel that. We haven't practiced, we add extra arrows of reaction, of resistance. So I was practicing in a meditation retreat. It was actually a training program at the DPP, and I developed a kidney stone. And the kidney stone, it wasn't diagnosed for a while, and I was kind of a stubborn, stoic practitioner, and I just tried to practice with it, right? I mean, I wasn't in the hall. I was actually in my room kind of writhing in pain, and for some reason, I did that for 3 days before I finally said, I need some help. And they checked in on me, but finally, I went in, and they diagnosed the kidney stone, gave me morphine, and it felt much better, right? But during that time, I was practicing relaxing with the pain, trying not to grip it. I thought it was a lot of learning around that. But then that kidney stone actually was just stuck. It wasn't moving. And if you've ever had a kidney stone, if it doesn't move, it doesn't really hurt. But when it starts to move, that's when the ureter just screams at you, all these radiating pain. So about a month later, it decided to start to move again. And it was amazing to watch the pain arise, and almost instantaneously was the fear of that pain and what the pain represented. Not having good health insurance and the ER visit and how long that's going to last and all these things flooded on. I saw, oh, I just made that pain. I multiplied how bad it was. And that was a direct seeing, a direct knowing of that. And each one of us have examples of that. That's where the homework is, to call forth what you see in your own life. How you notice when you add extra, what has the practice taught you? And pain is often one we can learn a lot about. And the final characteristic is that of anatta, or non-self. And this is kind of the nature of this hologram, is that if we really explore impermanence, we naturally start to understand non-self. If we really understand dukkha, we also leads us into understanding non-self. Now, impermanence is a lovely gateway to this, because for most of us, the sense of self just feels like this solid thing, right? It's like an operating system that's running in the background. Everything is being interpreted through that sense of self. But actually, if we look closely, there's moments during the day when that sense of self is actually very quiet or even absent. But we don't really notice those because we're so focused on when we're reactive, when we're wanting something or not wanting something, we're having an opinion, our thoughts. But yet there's these little moments of stillness that we kind of, our attention glosses over. As we practice more, it's interesting, those moments become longer and more established and deeper. Partly because something in us really longs for that. Something of us starts to resonate with that. And so those moments of stillness, of that quietness, that nothing needs to be changed in this moment. There's a simple abiding in this moment. We actually find that's where we want to abide. That's where we want to live and be with. Sometimes these moments arise more dramatically in some of the kind of fringes of our experience. I remember seeing my daughter when she was first born, that beauty and that wonder of this experience of seeing this new being. Being with someone who's dying also puts into that, sets into that quality of stillness. If we're not lost in our grief or feeling that in that moment, if we're able just to realize this is a precious thing, this transition from living to dying. Nature can often do that if we just open our eyes to it. The beauty of a sunrise, the beauty of seeing a wild animal. We don't have to actually comment on it. We can simply just be with it, be connected with it. It's like the experience becomes, is too big for the sense of self to hold. It's too big for our eyes or our words to hold. And so instead, something else comes forth. You get out of the way to allow that sense of self to fall away. You could ask like something essential, or really our essence, to come forth to meet it. Now, usually we focus so much of our attention upon when the sense of self is focused, because it feels like me. And in fact, it is me, right? I have this opinion, I have this idea, I have this concept, this dream, this fear of the future. But that's just our bias of our attention toward it. And this is one of the fundamental knowledge is this fundamental insight that we start to see and get more and more experiential experience around. In some ways, you've probably heard of that book, Drawing on the Right Side of the Brain. And in that book, I haven't really read it, but I read the first part of it. Well, the author is talking about, instead of drawing the object, draw the space around it. Actually see the air around it, see the space that's containing it. And that's one way to go into this sense of self, is see what's around it, those spaces around it. So impermanence can be this gateway into this sense of self. You start to see the rising and falling of it. You know, Heclites, I love his this quote that you can't step in the same river twice because you're not the same person and it's not the same river. This also becomes the dharma of dukkha of suffering becomes a gateway into the sense of self. We can almost say that when the sense of self is arisen, there's also dukkha. When there's sense of self is here, there's going to be some pain. Right? The pain might come later. Like if it's a positive sense of self, like I'm feeling really excited and happy about this, it's usually conditional, right? When those conditions change, what happens to that? There's remorse, there's wanting to get back, there's the longing, the grief of that passing. Or if it's a sense of self that's painful, that's where the suffering is right there. And so it kind of boils down to that. When the sense of self is arising, that's when there's suffering with it. Now, the sense of self is a really tricky practice because, I mean, for years I was really obsessed with the sense of self, and I was really trying to use the sense of self to understand and see the sense of self. But it doesn't work because it's part of the same logic. It's trying to see something with the thing itself. It's like those two mirrors parallel to each other. You look in one, you just see yourself reflected endlessly into infinity, smaller and smaller versions of you. And you can practice, okay, I get really quiet, I see that sense of self, but then, okay, what's seeing that sense of self? Well, that's another sense of self. Okay, let's get quieter. You see the witness of the witness, the witness of the witness of the witness. It gets very, very subtle, right? This is actually helpful territory, even though it doesn't work ultimately. Because it does work, because what's happening is you're starting to create more space for what's outside the sense of self to arise. The good news is we're actually not trying to make something that's not already here. We're not trying to obtain something that's esoteric or something that's difficult. We're actually just trying to get out of the way of our true nature. And that's actually good news, right? It's like when we stop trying to do things, when we stop trying to be the right meditator or be enlightened, we actually relax, that's when the sense of self falls away. There's a very first instructions you may have heard, or I started tonight, to see what's present, create space around it, have compassion, allow it to be just how it is. You take that very deeply, what's left is this sense of interconnection, this sense of unity. It's not because you created the sense of unity, as you stop being apart from it. You stopped holding yourself apart from it. So it's much more about surrendering and releasing into than trying to obtain. We often talk about knowledge, intellectual knowledge about interconnection and kind of sense of oneness, unity. And we often think of it as, okay, I am somehow going to become connected to everything. But it's really when we release that sense of separation, that's when we realize the actual truth of unity, the truth of interconnection. And there's nothing in those moments, there's really nothing that you can claim as you. It doesn't make sense to claim it as yours. It doesn't make sense to claim it as something personal. And yet, there's something that you are experiencing, something that you're connected with. So for each one of us, find the gateway that works for you. You know, I listed the three characteristics. There's other gateways. But the purpose is to learn to see what, maybe there's intellectual knowledge. How can I make that direct knowledge through my own experience? Something resonates. How does it show up in the landscape, in the laboratory of my own life, in my own heart? And this is what the practice is about. All right, let's sit quietly for a couple moments, letting those words settle. All right, before we open to any questions or sharing you might have, I just want to go over the homework. So online, I put that in the chat. And Bob, if you can, if you could reach, post that. And for those in the room, there's paper copies for you. So it's around knowledge and vision. And the title of this talk is The Direct Knowing of Insight. So reflect on your practice, how your practice has changed your understanding. So reflect on how your practice has changed your understanding. What did you used to believe in that was true that Dharma practice has shown you otherwise? Okay, so it's not like I used to believe in Santa Claus and now I don't. It's more like what assumptions have I had in my life? Am I still coming through or am I quiet now? Still good? What has practice shown you is not as true? And then here's the tricky part. Try to articulate that as clearly as you can. I think often we have these insights or these understandings, but we kind of ponder it, but we don't put it into something that actually makes, how clear can we be with it? It's kind of opposite of what I said about not making it too solid, but I think the articulation helps to clarify it. And next week I'll do a recap of this talk and a shorter version of it. And have you a chance to talk among yourselves, to talk about what you have noticed. How has practice transformed you? And how does this translate into your daily life? All right, so enjoy that homework, and next week I'll enjoy hearing you talk about it. So if there are any questions or sharing, so online you could just raise your virtual hand, and in the room you can raise your physical hand. All right, Ryan over here. And then we'll get to you next, Monica.
Hi. This is something I just wanted a clarification on.
Yes.
We talk about non-attachment. That's not the same as indifference, right? Because if we want to right practice, skillful practice.
Yeah.
We want to not be attached to it, but we still want to do it.
Yes. And I actually rarely use those words, non-attachment, because they're just so fraught with, okay, don't be attached. It's so easy for us to go into indifference, disconnection, and denial of what our, it's like, okay, I'm not attached to this. When I really am, it's really, I'm trying to deny the fact that I'm attached. But true non-attachment is more of this, it's not something that we have manufactured or created or a stance. It's much more of a relationship to just allowing things to be just how they are. It's this coming and going. It's really connected to this quality of impermanence. And underneath that, the less invested we are, the less identified we are, the much easier it is to be not attached. So if not attachment is, yes, not indifference. It's not that sense of disconnection. It's, in some ways, it's It allows us to be fully connected, to be fully with another person, with that experience, with ourselves. Is if we're not identified with it, if we're not attached to it, we can actually are free to really be present with it. And we often notice that when someone has an agenda, when they're listening to you, like they want to solve or fix your problem, or they're maybe reactive to it, or they're uncomfortable with it, whatever it is, versus when someone just tell me how you're doing and really listen to you. Yeah, that's a different way. It's actually very intimate with this experience. But also, there's no strings attached. And so there's a way that non-attachment in its deeper ways allows us to be fully connected and fully kind of with this experience. Does that help?
Yeah.
Yeah, thanks for your question. Okay, Monica, go ahead.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, we'll pop up the volume a little bit.
Okay, thanks, Tim. I appreciated the difference you made between experiential learning and, you know, kind of intellectual or something you read in a book. And my question is, why is experiential learning often so arduous? What can we make to make it more like the snorkeling example, where you're open, going with curiosity?
Sure.
Because some of the stories that you tell yourself about yourself, you know, in my case, you know, my story used to be that I'm terrible at my work, and somehow I gained that story through, you know, people in my past. But, you know, like, I didn't know that this story was a wrong story until I really had to open up to my experience of possibly being bad at work. But I mean, it was absolutely excruciating to stay there. So like, how does this, is it just like by its nature hard, or any tips?
Well, I'll just make a plug for the sense of perseverance, that when things are hard, you know, the perseverance of being able to be with it, even though, because there's a part of you that stayed with it, that was willing to keep practicing with it. Even though it was really hard, there's a sense of you that, okay, there must be some way through it. And so sometimes our society has a really distorted view of struggle, I think, at times, that, you know, we shouldn't really be struggling. We should be like world-class athletes the first time we go do something. And we don't, we kind of discount just, you know, the joy of struggle a little bit. And joy is kind of, it's not fun, right? But it can have a joy. But to get back to your question, I would say that you talked about the story of you not being good at work, or whatever that, you know, whatever that story is. It's like, notice, what am I believing is true? That's often what makes things really hard, is that, what am I believing is true in this moment, or about myself, about this situation, about whatever I'm working on? And then just suspend that belief. And that allows you to actually practice. Because if you imagine, so now I think you don't take that so strongly, that belief in so strongly, right? What if you held that, if you knew that, if you could go back and tell yourself, hey, that's not true. You don't have to believe that, then practice would have been much easier. So what I would say, so just when you find yourself struggling, just step back a little bit and maybe write out, what am I believing is true? What assumptions am I making about how I should be in this moment? How my mind should be, how my practice should be. Write those out and just say, each one of those, kind of suspend the energy into believing it's true. Be willing to, you know, doubt those, have wise doubt around that. And what that does, that allows the wonder to open, right? That allows the, okay, if I'm not believing that, then I don't know what this is. And that starts to become this gateway into true connection.
I thought you would say that the hard stuff is just part of us. At this point of my practice, it's a good answer, but I couldn't handle it before. So,
yes. Thanks. Yeah, the hard part, yeah, it's part of our practice. But the good news is that if we have the perseverance to work with one of the hard pieces, once we see through it, we can extrapolate that all the other hard places, they're not as hard anymore. Because a lot of it really comes down to this sense of identification, this sense of what I am, I, me, and mine. We start to see through that, then everything else starts to become a little less solid. It's like, you know, this before I started to practice, they seemed so solid, so strong. But through Dharma practice, you see that sense of self is actually much more fluid, much more loose. And then all these psychological stuff loses its grip, loses its power.
Thank you.
Thank you, Monica. All right, let's go to Claire, and then we'll go back in the room and see if there's anyone. Go ahead, Claire.
Thank you for the beautiful talk. I don't know where my question is in this, but my experience is that when I was five, my mother died, and when I was, you know, 60 or 65, I broke up with a partner of 20 years. So that breakup, even though it was instigated by me, it was, it completely threw me back to my mother dying. And I went through 2 years of, like really intense feeling of all that. And actually that's when I got very committed to insight meditation. But so I just wonder, I can't quite make sense of this. If I experienced that loss when I was five, I mean, I was only five, but still I was a whole human being.
Mm-hmm.
And then experiencing it again 60 years later, I didn't have that experience somehow to remind me that all things, that nothing's permanent. I don't know. I'm not sure where my question is, but I hope you can see where it is.
Sure. Well, I mean, part of it, you know, as we talk about our heart and grief and the mind, there's these kind of overlaps of, you know, where's kind of the Dharma realm, where's the psychological realm, and you know, there's a lot of overlap between those two. You know, from, you know, one perspective is, you know, as a five-year-old, you grieve very differently than a 60-year-old, right? You have a different understanding, different meaning, different, you know, probably duration of how long you were with that person than you were even with your mom, for example. You know, so there's a different way that grief comes up. Sometimes it's just also how well have we grieved before. You know, maybe that grief wasn't as complete when you were a five-year-old. And so there's kind of this backlog of grief that's kind of waiting to have another door open through another loss to be able to be felt. So this is part of this. This is where we kind of get tripped up in life, is that sometimes we think, okay, this has to be just Dharma or it has to be just psychological. And we sometimes deny one or the other. So part of it is, you know, okay, I'm going to grieve this as fully as I can. I'm going to just meet you, Monica. We grieve everything as fully as we can, but there's also this sense of noticing that me-ness, that sense of self that arises in relationship to that. And this really, for myself, really helps unhook the whole psychological process, because often psychological process helps to kind of polish up or soothe this sense of self. You know, and that territory being able to open to, you know, the ways the self gets battered and hurt, traumatized, is experience and loss, that's really helpful. And also to realize that there's something beyond that sense of self. In some ways, sometimes that grief opens us up to this vastness of if we take it from the personal to this impersonal, then we see, okay, this is shared by everyone. This is not just me. So I don't know if I'm making any sense, but I would say, It's part of this human condition. In some ways, it doesn't matter why the five-year-old grief and the 60-year-old grief kind of came together, or kind of you felt some intertwining of that. It's just, this is, it's like we don't really don't know why we're given things to open to, but our job is to open to them.
Okay, I'll think about that. Thank
Yeah.
you so much.
Yes. Yes, go ahead. We'll bring the mic up for you.
Hi, thank you so much for your talk tonight.
Sure.
I really appreciated this idea of the like conceptual knowing and then the felt knowing.
Yes.
And I've been really challenged by, I have a conceptual understanding that I don't need everyone to like me, but it's so hard for me in the moment. And I think for karmic reasons, I'm a therapist to people with mostly targeting aggressive tendencies towards others. So every day I'm disliked and it has not gotten any easier. It breaks my heart every time. And I have all the, I think I have some of the conceptual wisdom around this, but I feel I am in the butting my head up against it stage.
Yeah. So this, I'll kind of share my own experience, not exactly like yours, but I think it will resonate. So like for myself, a lot of it was a sense of deep shame or inadequacy, see something fundamentally flawed with me and seeing all the ways I would kind of adapt to try to get love or approval or hide parts of myself. And I would, you know, work with it and open to it, but still there's something that's kind of like what I believed is true. Right. So all the other stuff is kind of like function, making more functional, but deep down, that's kind of the belief. And so at some point, I it's easier to practice this probably on your own, not in the middle of someone projecting on you because they've, you know, they have their own stuff that's unclear. But to take what that energy of it and take it down, what I, a nice gateway is just to notice, okay, what's the body's experience of it? What that does is it grounds you into the present moment. Okay, there's this tightness here. And then start to notice, just ask gently, what is it that I'm believing in is true in this moment? What I, and you can often see those deeper layers. But then you just keep on going. It's like there's like subfloors and subfloors and subfloors. Until you kind of get to something, you start to see surprising aspects. I think that's a key piece. It's because there's, because you know the territory very well. But there's some part of the territory that you don't know. And by doing this kind of no agenda, not trying to get rid of it, but just to try to understand it in a full, deep way, what you're understanding is kind of the mechanism that's created this sense of self that forms around it. It's a really helpful sense of mechanism, right? You know, if you, you know, the sense of inadequacy really forms a sense of self. It's almost like it's really doing a good job of keeping me intact. So it's kind of a willingness to see what's outside of that sense of self. Right, but you do it through curiosity and let it kind of reveal itself. And it's not going to be something that you're going to, you know, do in 20 minutes and you're done. Right? It's going to be kind of more of a process of months or years. But to help it be more accurate is that willingness to see what's actually here. And you start to get to the core of it and notice how I found for myself when I really connected with the core of it, I noticed, oh, wow, this is connected to all these strands in my life. Actually saw how they would bias and change the way I perceive things. I mean, I literally opened the mailbox and noticed, oh, I'm expecting some rejection. I would hear the phone and I go, someone's calling to criticize. But it's like, but I could see it from not a way that was overwhelming, but more, oh, wow, this is how my mind is making sense of the world, right? And, you know, you can, there's all the psychological piece of where you, how is a, you know, survival situation, strategy or strategy to be loved, in your, whatever it was, you probably know all of that. But we're looking from the sense of self's perspective. And at some point you see something that's, oh, I didn't realize this part of it. It's kind of a, it's like, oh, wow, it's a different emotion or a different thing that comes up. And you just keep following that to the point where it's almost like, the way I like to describe it, like this bowl represents the thing. And I'm usually just seeing this one aspect. At some point I see all the way around it. I see it really as a belief that's not true anymore. But until I see all the way around it, this part that's anchored is still making it so solid. But I finally see around it, it's like everything kind of lifts from it. And you see that sense of self that forms around that deep belief. It's just a belief. And then there's a freedom from that. It doesn't mean it's still not going to be a, it's going to be a tender area. You know, it's going to be an area that sometimes gets triggered, but there could be so much more freedom around it. You just don't believe in it in the same way. Does that kind of make sense?
Yeah. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Yeah, so practice this. Make it, if you're interested in it, just like I was like a bloodhound trying to smell the subtle scent of that every time it would show up. It's much easier working when it's subtle, it's low stakes. If I have a client like projecting all their anger at me, it's hard to do that. But if you're going on a walk in the park or just having these little interactions with strangers, you notice it arise, that's the time to practice with it. And then you learn a lot from it, and then eventually you become free of it. Yeah, thank you for that question. All right, go ahead, Kathy.
Thank you, Tim. I've kind of got a laundry list here of surprising things. This is a productive little exercise, but one of them is that I think before I began to practice, I believed that my life was a clear path of improvement toward progress and perfection or whatever. And I believe that, but a contradictory, I would believe that my pain was the worst possible when no one else could ever have it or understand it. And I believed my views were right. I think just odd things. I just realized I really didn't have much, I don't want to sound too judgmental here, but I'm realizing now I didn't have much insight into my inner, how I really am, how I really am in the world. So maybe I'd be interested if you had any comments about that.
Well, first of all, I really appreciate the way you're able to articulate exactly what those beliefs were. That you're on a path to perfection and your suffering is the worst in human existence. Be able to articulate that, because a lot of these beliefs are kind of like, they're kind of amorphous, they're a little bit unseen, but because they're unseen, they have a strong current that's driving us. And you, through your practice, you're able to see each one of those and state them. And then now you see that they're not so true, right? Each one of those is not so true anymore. And that sense of movement from what you believed is true to what you realize is not true, that's what the practice has shown you, right? And that's kind of the home purpose of the homework, is to do that. And then the next stage is to realize the things that you believe now is true, maybe they're not as true as you thought, as you think they are now.
Here we go. it's good. I like it.
And if you want the extra credit piece, is kind of the core one, is that there is a sense of self that's solid.
Yeah.
That's really who and what you are, right? So that's, if we're honest, most of us, that's really what I am. I really am this sense of self. But just like those other things, at some point you thought that's really how things are. And through practice, you realize that that's not actually the truth.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's tough to apply it to myself. I'll give it a try. Thank you, Tim.
Yeah, it's a simple recipe. Just whatever you believe is true, just be willing to pretend it's not. Mm. Interact with life as if it's not. Practice seeing as if it's not.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks.
And if we really do that, it can bring a sense of sometimes disquiet or trepidation or even terror, because if we're really not following those, we don't. It's a territory we have never been on before. We don't know who and what we are outside of that sense of self. And that's a good, it's like, instead of being don't enter this way, that's what we're reading, don't enter, but it's actually, this is the pathway, is to be willing to go a place where we don't know who and what we are. We'll still know how to do our jobs and do all the things we do, just that sense of self won't be believed in. All right, anyone else?
Thanks so much, Tim. One question I have that I'm kind of grappling with is how to kind of have this inner knowing of non-self, but also orient towards wholesome qualities.
Mm-hmm.
If you could speak to that.
Yeah. Yeah. So the wholesome qualities and understanding the non-self. Yeah. It's sometimes there's a paradox, right? How do I be a generous person if there's not a person to be generous from? Right? How do I have loving qualities? And actually, it's less of a contradiction than we first think it is. So, in other words, let's say you wanted to be a ungenerous person, a greedy person, and you wanted to be a hateful person. Those are all going to kind of that pathway is going to make the sense of self stronger. But if you practice being generous, for example, or being kind, that by nature tends to loosen up the sense of self, starts to soften it up. Because if I really, let's say generosity is a path I want to practice, to be really generous, I start to see all the places where that sense of self contracts and not doesn't want to be. And say, I want to be kind. Okay, I don't want to be kind to this person or to this situation or this condition. If I can meet that, but not with a sense of shooting, this is how I should be, but more like, okay, my practice, my intention to be kind or generous or loving is showing up this kind of backlash or this resistance. If I can meet that resistance not as a problem or as an obstacle, but actually as a gift, well, I can understand something about myself. I can understand the nature of this. And this is similar to the question around it was deep patterns, is how can I open to that? Feel that more clearly. Because ultimately, when you think about any of those positive qualities, you know, the sense of self being absent allows them to actually blossom. Yeah, so it's a powerful way to practicing it. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, I think some of like the more negative qualities, it's easy to see through the delusion of that, but then the positive ones, it's like more comfortable to be with those and create the sense of self. So that's helpful.
Yeah, what's one you're working on? Do you mind sharing?
In terms of
the positive qualities.
Positive. Yeah, I think I've been working a lot with compassion. The
okay,
mudita.
Compassion. Yeah. So compassion. It's like we have. It's like we set the intention to go this particular way. And you just start to notice when it gets a little distorted, right? So like, and you often see it as when you judge yourself for not being compassionate, you judge others for not being compassionate. There's kind of a hardness that comes from that. But you also see there's moments or times that you're just naturally compassionate when it feels really, it's given without strings, without it. And you learn from that. So you will learn both how you kind of harden around it. And that's where the practice of mindfulness is kind of the saving grace for it. It's kind of a self-correcting mechanism. If we're willing to really be attuned to it, we can start to sense when we're selfing around it. We start to harden around it. Yeah, and it just feels a little bit off, right? And, you know, if you have loved ones or partners, they can give you feedback too. You know, I do that with my wife gives me feedback sometimes if I'm kind of taking on airs of being a kind person, but there's a little bit of a, you know, better than or, you know, pitying or something that's distorted, you know, she'll let me know. Or, you know, my daughter will let me know. Yeah, so you kind of, you have people in your life who can kind of call you on it when you're off a bit.
Thank you.
Yeah. All right, go ahead, Nina. That will be our last question.
Hi. Thank you so much for that talk. I just want to say quickly, I really appreciate how you described when meditating and investigating how there are different layers of insight that come to you. Mm. Like there's different levels, you know, like, you know, I've been dealing with a personal issue and really have been doing some concentration and meditation work on it. And just so many aspects of, I guess, myself have come through and have helped to enlighten me. So I think I didn't realize that before. So thank you.
Yes, so that's a powerful part of being a homeowner or a householder or having a life that's integrated, is that all those things are transfer practice, and actually the way you're practicing with it allows the insights of your long practice to really show up in those difficult things of our life. So thank you for sharing that, Nina. All right, so we've come to our 9 o'clock ending time. So I want to thank everyone for your questions and your engagement. And next week we'll have a recap talk and then a chance for you to actually talk with each other, explore this topic. And it's a powerful thing to do, is actually, you know, articulate what you've understood, what you see for yourself is true, and to hear each other and support each other in that growth. All right, so thank you, and we'll see you next time, wherever that might be. And thanks for all the volunteers.